Okay, welcome everybody to the Institute of Philosophy's London Aesthetics Forum. It's very nice to see so many of you here. First, I just want to thank the British Society of Aesthetics who helped to sponsor us, which is much appreciated. And second, I'd like to welcome our speaker for today, Professor Anthony Saville. Professor Saville is an emeritus professor at King's College London, and I'm sure many of you know him for his work in aesthetics or in history of modern philosophy, where he's worked, I think, especially on 17th century rationalism and on Kant. And today he's here to talk to us about Kant and purposiveness and the point of poetry.
Thank you very much. I don't really have a prepared speech, so I'm just going to gas until I run out of fuel. What I would like to do is to persuade you, against all the appearances, that we really do have something very important to learn from Kant's aesthetics. And that, as far as I can see, nobody yet has learnt it, so you will be the first. Let me just say something about the frustrations of the critique of judgment, which we all meet when we encounter this horrendously written text. Pretends to be largely about beauty, but I guess that's very hard to be persuaded of. The story is cast in terms of pleasure in the first paragraph of the main section. Lust and Unlust. There's not much lust connected with beauty, I think. That doesn't seem to be quite the right notion. Then, it's difficult to see exactly what Kant is about, but somehow what he is about turns out to revolve around the idea of purposiveness. And one wonders what on earth that means. And when we find out what it means, we're told it has something to do with the free play of the cognitive faculties working together. That seems to be even more obscure than purposefulness. And then when we've got through to the end of the Analytic of the Beautiful, we hope to learn something continuous about the way in which aesthetic judgment operates within the arts. It's extremely difficult to see that there's a unity between what Kant is talking about when he talks about the pure judgment of taste and the kinds of judgments of taste that we meet when we talk about the arts. And finally, you can hear Kant galloping towards his conclusion. It's all got to do with morality. And that surely is a disappointment. So there are a number of frustrations. But my God, the man's a genius. He's got something absolutely right. The thing is that we can't see what it is. And commentators don't help. I'm one of them, I'm afraid. Commentators don't help for the reason that what they do is that they stick their noses closer and closer and closer to the text, and they lose the forest for the trees. And it's the forest that is interesting more than the individual trees that make it up. So I would like, at least today, when I get round to the end of talking about the point of poetry, which is really what I am interested in, and which I think Kant is interested in too, I would like to be able to step back from the text and talk in rather general terms about what I think he believes to be going on. I talk about the point of poetry. We shouldn't read that as a definite description. An important point of poetry, perhaps one of the most important. Okay, so let's straighten out at least two of those embarrassments to start with. When Kant talks about the beautiful, my view is that what he's really on about is the general range of positive aesthetic engagement that we have with things. That he uses the word beautiful, that's Schöner, is we can treat it more or less as a dummy. And he's not, as a matter of fact, engaged in providing an analysis of a very, very specific concept there. Then what about lust and unlust? Pleasure and unpleasure. I think that's just an unfortunately chosen word. what is much more satisfactory is his other term of positive engagement, satisfaction, Wohlgefallen. And so what he's interested in is the satisfaction that we find in positive aesthetic experience of this, that, or the other. Things in nature, works of art, people, moral sentiments. Well, forget about moral sentiments. Then, what is the main problem? What is the main problem? I think, for Kant, the main problem is this. He is convinced that the aesthetic judgments that we make are truth apt. They are good candidates for being true or false. And that has to be explained. That has to be explained in a way which is continuous with the explanation that Kant wants to give of truth aptness in sciences, or as regards to the natural world, independently of the way in which we react to it, with it. I just say I'd like to set aside, if I can, all discussion of transcendental idealism here. Just remember that Kant talks of himself as an empirical realist as well as a transcendental idealist. So he thinks that there is at least univocity of the idea of truth as it applies both in the natural sciences and in the natural world and to our aesthetic engagement with the world. The problem is to explain how that's possible. And that is, I think, the fundamental problem of critique of judgment, but the aesthetic bit of it anyway. Let me just say a little word about Kant's notion of truth. He doesn't really have much of a discussion about what he thinks truth is, but in the Prolegomena, truth is fairly quickly characterized in terms of universal and necessary validity of our judgments. So universal and necessary validity. I think that comes to the thought that judgment is true, providing that everyone has good reason to assent to it, and that someone who doesn't is getting things wrong, saying something false. There's plenty of room in the middle. You just have to sit on the floor. If you want a chair, I will sit in the middle and talk from there. Yes. Just come in and make yourself comfortable somewhere if you can. That's a challenge. Have a seat. Look. I shall stand, so I don't need this. Come on, someone with courage. Ladies first.
Come on, lady, come under the table.
I can't go on until you do it. Someone.
Health and safety issue that you're having over anyway.
This is the condition for the talk to continue.
It would be easier if we just made room for people. It's otherwise going to be uncomfortable. Well done. Thank you very much. Good.
Sorry.
That's right. We can ask you the questions later. Great. Okay. Now I'll go on. So I was saying, I thought that the main problem that Kant faces is to explain how aesthetic judgments of a positive kind really are good candidates for being truth apt. And he reckons that what he has to do in order to secure that result is to make out that they are universally and necessarily valid. Meaning, I think, something along the lines that, well, if a judgment is true, then everyone who considers the matter ought to give it their assent. There are good reasons why they should. And in the domain of scientific, what Kant calls cognitive and logical judgments, that demand is satisfied by the existence of a determinate proof, so that for any such judgment, there's a way simply of deciding whether or not it is universally and necessarily valid. True. But the beginning of the critique starts off from the thought that aesthetic judgments are not cognitive. They're not cognitive, they are highly subjective. They are responses to, or they're validated by responses of Lust and Unlust, or satisfaction, Wohlgefallen. And the question is how that can be squared with the thought that if they're to be true, they have to be universally necessarily valid. And having said that, just remember that the first five sections of, the first five sections of the critique are the claim that the judgment that something is beautiful is subjective and not cognitive. The second section is that it's universally valid. The fourth section is that it's necessarily valid. And the third section is what is supposed to provide the backing for the claim that aesthetic judgments are universally and necessarily valid. And that is where we meet the ghastly idea of purposiveness. So it's that certain features of objects are, quote, purposive, is what secures, if anything does, the universal and necessary validity of judgments of taste. And if Kant can make that out, then he will have succeeded in doing what he wants to make out that aesthetic judgments are indeed good candidates for truth, aptness, truth or falsity. So we have to ask, what on earth is purposiveness? What is purposiveness? Is it just a Kantian word, Zweckmäßigkeit? In particular, it's made worse by the fact that it's purposiveness without a purpose, Zweckmäßigkeit ohne Zweck. So what's that? Okay, the little quotation that I've put as number B here is Kant's introduction on the sheet. Does anyone not have a sheet of quotations? Are any spares? Martin?
There should be two spares.
Right. Yes. Okay, good. So, I've slightly simplified the quotations. The causality of a concept in respect of its object is its purposiveness. That's the sentence that matters. Where there's not merely the cognition of an object, but the object itself is thought as an effect only possible by means of a concept of this latter, there we think a purpose. Well, alpha-grade obscurity. Alpha-grade obscurity. Okay, what's going on there? I think the idea of causality is, we can just put in terms of makes. So falling under a certain concept makes something the case. There's a way in which Kant thinks that that kind of sentence will introduce the idea of causality. But we have to be careful how it's done. Of course, I might say, look, putting two atoms of hydrogen together with one of oxygen gives me a molecule of water. That things fall under that mixture of elements makes for something being water. That's not what Kant must mean here, because that's a truth whether we think of it in that way or not. So what's important is the way which we think of something making it to be what it is. That's the way in which a concept is thought of as causal for the object. The way in which we think about the object makes it what it is, the object that it is. And Kant gives two examples of the sorts of things that he thinks satisfy that description, but which are actually not of the right sort. And it helps just to go through a couple of examples, just to see the way in which his mind is moving. So he thinks that purposiveness expressed like that can be with a purpose in two different ways, either idiosyncratically, subjectively, as he puts it, or else more generally. So let's take the idiosyncratic case first. What you want this evening is a good dinner companion. And you ask me, who shall I ask out to dinner? And I say, well, Knowing you and knowing Simon's sense of humour, Simon would be a very good dinner companion for you. A man with a sense of humour like that, sensitivity to that sort of humour, makes Simon a good dinner companion for you. Not for anyone else, perhaps, but certainly for you. So that's a way in which thinking of Simon as falling under that property, under that description, makes for Simon as a good dinner companion for you. An objective case would be a case where we have an interest in some general need which we all encounter. So we all want something for making coffee. It's called a kettle. What makes for something to be a kettle? Well, that it's thought of as being suitable for boiling water. So again, thinking of something as falling under the concept of being suitable for boiling water makes an object a kettle, roughly. And in those two examples, the idea of purposiveness was with a purpose, that is, as answering to a particular desire which we have for a good dinner companion in a personal case, or for a utensil for serving coffee up. And, of course, Kant has already laid down in the first sections of the critique that the judgment that something is beautiful is disinterested. And disinterested means that the pleasure that it gives rise to, satisfaction that it gives us, is independent of its satisfying any particular desires. So the good dinner companion and the kettle would not count as purposiveness without a purpose. They would count as purposiveness, purposive with a purpose. So the point at which we've arrived is where Kant has to answer the question, now, you're pretending that this idea of purposiveness without a purpose is going to be what provides the answer to the question, how can aesthetic judgments sensibly be characterised as true or false? And he has to tell us what purposiveness without a purpose is. And what he says, the only thing that he actually says, is what I've got at the first little quotation on the sheet. The state of mind in the representation of something beautiful must be a feeling of the harmonious free play of the powers of imagination, gathering together the manifold of intuition, and understanding, supplying the concept, uniting the representations. That is supposed to be what is going to provide us with the understanding of what it is for something to be purposive without a purpose. It's not. So let's just say a little bit about that. The nut that has to be cracked is free play. What the hell is free play of the cognitive faculties? And it's a truth that if you read the commentators, you get noses stuck to the text. The three favourite candidates are that what we're concerned with is precognitive operation of the mind, or multi-cognitive operation of the mind, or meta-cognitive operation of the mind. Obscurity-producing terms are catalogued in a paper by Paul Geyer in his collection of essays, Values of Beauty. It's called The Harmony of the Faculties Revisited. I would recommend you to read it only for fun. What is absolutely striking is that no one actually turns their mind to asking the question, what might Kant actually be talking about? Rather, it's what might his words mean in his own, expressed in the kind of vocabulary that he himself uses, which is, after all, a very dense curtain, difficult to penetrate. So, Let's talk just a bit about Kant's conception of perceptual experience, where imagination and understanding are operative together, and to produce cognition. This isn't a digression, we have to go through this little route. Those of us who've been brought up in the empiricist tradition, practically all of us, are liable to think of this as pretty straightforward. Imagination, after all, is perceptual. Input, images, and then the question is, images provided by causal interaction with the world around us, and understanding is the way in which we bring those images to bear in the picture of the world which we draw up. And that's not a very rewarding way of thinking about perceptual experience. And it isn't Kant's way either. What's important for Kant is that what imagination brings to this constructive enterprise of finding out how the world is displays itself. What imagination does is to build up over time schemata with which we enrich our understanding. So to give you a kind of example, which I think is helpful, we experience things as this or that. Now, you might find yourself in front of a building with a friend. You might see it as the front of a house, and the friend who has the same perceptual input might see it as a house facade. On Kant's view, your experiences are different. Your experiences are different because the schemata of imagination which you both brought to bear on the perceptual input is different. And so the role of imagination is, if you like, building up a model of the world in terms of which we enrich our understanding of it. And we shouldn't think about perceptual experience just as bringing understanding to bear on some brute given by the senses. So the role of imagination as bringing a schemata, into the scene as we try and make sense of the world is crucial. And it's crucial in building up the cognition of the world which we arrive at when the faculties of imagination and understanding are working in harmony, but not in free play. Working in harmony, so they produce cognition, but that's not free play, as long as what we're concerned about is cognition understood as I described it at the very beginning, cognition of the brute, inert, mechanical world in which we live our lives out. And, of course, cognitive success is precisely what Kant thinks aesthetic success is not. So we have to see what free play offers, which enables him to distinguish cognitive success, where there is no free play, from aesthetic success, where there is free play, and free play of a kind which will enable us to say at the end of the day, our aesthetic judgments are candidates for being universally and necessarily valid, and hence truth apt. Now, when Kant addresses the question, what do you mean by free play? Unfortunately, in those sections where he does it, primarily section 9, 10, and 11, his response is entirely negative. That is, he says what it's not. And what it's not is the operation of imagination and understanding together to produce cognitive success. And that's where, as far as his elucidation of the idea, peters out. And as Gaia rightly says, what we need is a positive account, and then we get those three hilarious different positive accounts, none of which are actually terribly comprehensible. Now, I think that this is the point at which Kant didn't understand what he was doing. Perhaps that's a little unfair. If he understood what he was doing, he wasn't able to say so. But there are, I think, two sentences in the Critique of Judgment which are not immediately connected with that problem, what is the free play of imagination, which tell us the way in which his mind is moving. And I've written them down as quotations C and D, C turns up in section 23 of the Critique, and D turns up in section 49, though I didn't write it down. Probably because I've slightly altered the translation. So let's just read them through. The self-standing beauties of nature reveal in us an inborn propensity and a technique de natura to view nature as a system in accordance with laws, the principles of which we don't find in the whole of our faculty of understanding. That principle is the principle of purposiveness in respect of the use of our judgment in regard to phenomena, which requires that they be judged not just as belonging to nature in its purposeless mechanism, but also as belonging to something analogous to art. I like the expression, eine Technik der Natur, which no one has translated properly. Barnard calls it the technique of nature, which doesn't mean very much. Meredith, improving it, calls it a technique of nature, which isn't even an English word. And then Gaia goes back to a technique of nature. But I think what Kant is talking about is an innate psychological propensity, something which we do. That's what the technique of nature is, to my way. So what Kant is doing there is saying, when we make aesthetic judgments, we find ourselves exercising an inborn propensity to view things not quite in the light of cognitive matters, but something else. Something else which we should think of as not unlike the production of works of art. And then the second quotation, D, is where we learn a little bit more about this. Imagination as a productive faculty of cognition, is very powerful in creating another nature, as it were, out of the material that actual nature gives it. By it, imagination, we remold experience in accordance with analogical laws, which are just as natural to us as those by which understanding comprehends empirical nature, so that the material supplied to us by nature can be worked up into something which surpasses nature. So I think that when Kant draws upon his idea of the faculties of cognition in free play, he's talking just about this, the way in which, in aesthetic experience, we find ourselves constructing a world very different from the inert mechanism of the natural sciences, and something which surpasses, goes beyond that inert mechanistic conception of the world. And somehow, aesthetic experience is geared to that. I like the idea of Kant talking about our aesthetic experience providing us with a second nature, another nature. It's quite interesting that John McDowell says in one of his Kant lectures that Kant never had any idea like a second nature, and I think this just gives that a lie. It's also, in an interesting way, something which Kant was not the first to point to. And I found in Philip Sidney's Apology for Poetry, written about 1580, published 1583 or so, this reflection about the difference between poets and other makers. So Sidney starts off from the Greek word poiein and says, everyone starts off by working on the material that nature itself provides, but the poet does something more. And it's beautifully written, so I'll read it. It's more than can be said of anything that Kant wrote. There's no art delivered unto mankind that hath not the works of nature for his principal object, without which they could not consist, and on which they so depend as they become actors and players, as it were, of what nature will have set forth. Only the poet, disdaining to be tied to any such subjection, lifted up with the vigour of his own invention, doth grow, in effect, into another nature. In making things either better than nature bringeth forth, or quite anew, forms such as never were in nature. Nature never set forth the earth in so rich tapestry as divers poets have done, neither with so pleasant rivers, fruitful trees, sweet-smelling flowers, nor whatsoever else may make the too-much-loved earth more lovely. Her world is brazen. The poets only deliver a golden. Now, there is something which I think importantly differentiates Sidney and Kant here. Though in section 49 of the Critique of Judgment, Kant does give an example or two of the sorts of things that he thinks go into the second nature which imagination produces. And he talks either about the imagination bringing to our minds examples, particular examples of things that don't exist, like, or we never experience anyway, kingdom of the blessed, hell. Jotted down where his examples are coming. As Kant says, they interpret the sense rational ideas of invisible beings, the kingdom of the blessed, hell, eternity, creation, sorts of things which don't come our way. Or alternatively, imagination elaborates things which we do experience, death, envy, all vices, love, fame, transgressing the limits of experience. The poet aims to body them forth to sense with a completeness of which nature affords no parallel. That's another quotation from section 49. Now, I say, in that respect, I think Kant and Philip Sidney are one. But I think there is something ungenerous to Kant in letting things remain there. Because it seems to me that what we are offered by Sidney is the idea of the poet producing all sorts of marvels about the way in which we might imagine things, but we imagine them, as it were, from a distance. We are not engaged with them other than through our admiration. And I think that that is something which Kant wants to do better than, and wants to do it in a slightly different way. So there's a passage in which he says, poetry is the art of conducting a free play of the imagination as if it were a serious business of the understanding, giving life to the concepts of the understanding by means of the imagination. And I think that the idea of giving life to concepts of the imagination is giving life to them in such a way that they constitute our world, the world in which we live. Not the world in which we are onlookers, but the world in which we are actually players. that is our world. And that is the world that the poet can make ours. Now, that I think is you should be hearing the nut cracking at that point. I said the nut that has to be cracked is what on earth the free play of imagination and understanding comes to. What I'm saying to you now is that I think it comes to this, that in the free play of imagination and understanding, particularly as exercised in the arts, we are offered a way of understanding what the world has to offer us within our own perspective, not within the perspective of what Kant somewhere calls the technique of mechanisms, not just the mechanically organized world. It is, I think, that idea of making a world for us which is, where we take seriously the idea of a world which is made, that enables us to say that what Kant seems to be on about is the capacity that we find in our aesthetic experience to find a reality to the world which outstrips the reality that the sciences pretend to offer us. He does not say it explicitly, so you find it very difficult, actually, to tie that thought down to anything more than what Philip Sidney had said 200 years beforehand. But when you think about the way in which Kant is concerned with the construction of the world, which is ours, partly, of course, through the categories, partly through space and time, as functions of the mind, I think that the extension of the construction of the world in aesthetic experience takes us far beyond the idea that Philip Sidney finds so pleasing, and which he writes about so marvellously. The nearest, the next thing that I think we find in the history of the subject is Hegel trying to articulate an idea rather like that. And I quoted here on the last of those quotations a passage from the introduction to the lectures on aesthetics, where the crucial sentence is actually rather later in the quotation. But I will read it since it's I think an absolutely marvellous piece of philosophy. The universal and absolute need from which art springs has its origin in the fact that man is a thinking consciousness. That is, man draws out of himself and puts before himself what he is and whatever else is. Whatever else is, the rest of the world. Things in nature are only immediate and single. That's the mechanistic bit. While man, as spirit, duplicates himself to himself, thinks, and only on the strength of his active placing himself before himself is he spirit. This consciousness of himself man acquires in twofold ways. First, theoretically, insofar as inwardly he must bring himself into his own consciousness, along with whatever moves, stirs, and presses in the human breast. And in general, he must see himself, represent himself to himself, fix before himself what thinking finds as his essence, and recognize himself alone, alike in what is summoned out of himself and in what is accepted from without, that is, making the second nature out of what first nature provides. Secondly, man brings himself before himself by practical activity. Since he has the impulse, in whatever is directly given to him, in what is present to him externally, to produce himself, and therein equally to recognize himself. This aim he achieves by altering external things whereon he impresses the seal of his inner being and in which he now finds again his own characteristics. Man does this in order, as a free subject, to strip the external world of its inflexible foreignness and to enjoy, in the shape of things, only an external realization of himself. Even a child's first impulse involves this practical alteration of external things. The boy throws stones into the river and now marvels at the circles drawn in the water as an effect in which he gains an intuition of something that is his own doing. The bit that I think is for understanding Kant so important here is the last sentence but one. Man does this in order, as a free subject, to strip the external world of its inflexible foreignness and to enjoy, in the shape of things, only an external realization of himself. Strip the world of an inflexible foreignness. Without aesthetic experience, the thought would be, we would live alienated from the world in which we find ourselves. The role of the poet is to produce a world in which we internalize through our love of the poetry, and as a result of which, we find ourselves not alienated from the world which we would otherwise be, but for his gift. So, now let's, I think we can leave it for discussion whether this idea of Kant's is going to really capture what he wants, namely universality and necessary validity of aesthetic judgments in a way which secures their truth aptness. But I think that whether he succeeds or not, this idea of the free play of imagination and understanding, thought of in the way that I've tried to sketch for you, and that's what's going to have to do the work. One other remark I will make. I find myself growing up and thinking about the arts always very, very puzzled about the importance that people attached to that strange thing called expression and expressiveness. Not helped by Collingwood, and certainly not helped by Croce before him. I think, however, just a glimmering of my thought here, that maybe what Kant is talking about is what we would naturally think of today as falling within the umbrella of expressiveness in the arts. And maybe that what enables aesthetic judgments to claim truth is their success as recognizing and capturing the expressiveness of works of art and for ourselves as we walk through nature, the ways in which we appreciate the natural world, and we do. I think I've run out of gas.
Thank you very much.